Good morning. Are you feeling good this morning? Should be feeling good this morning, as beautiful as it is outdoors, and the chance that we have to come together and to worship our great God, to receive communion together, and to understand the freedom and the forgiveness that we have in Jesus Christ, that ought to fill you with some level of feeling good, of joy, of excitement. You know, in addition to that, we got The Westwood Lady Warriors and the Round Rock Lady Dragons are still in the state tournament in volleyball. I mean, it's just hardly getting better than that, right? I mean, it should be just, you know, even you Longhorn fans got vindicated yesterday. So, I mean, it's a great, great, great time, right? But I have a feeling that if we peel back the surface, many of us would not be feeling that way. And why should we? For almost 2 years now, we've had both political parties and their candidates going back and forth telling us just how terrible everything is, and you know how bad our country is, and how bad we're doing in the world, and how bad we're doing in the economy. And then 2 months ago, we found out that they were right. Like, it is bad. And people are struggling. We've seen the unemployment numbers going up. We saw the housing market 16% decline nationwide in the cost or in the price of our homes when we've got second and third mortgages, so we really owe more than what we actually have. In fact, in October, Gallup did a poll, and in that poll, they discovered that 53% of the Americans, people in the United States, are angry about the economy and what's taken place in the last couple months. Just angry about it. And 41% are worried. Last month, the consumer confidence level dropped to the lowest it's been since it started 40 years ago. This week had the privilege of meeting with a group of people that contribute heavily to an international ministry. I was the keynote speaker Friday night to this group of large donors who support East-West Ministries, which is a ministry agency that goes around the world. And I've got a really good friend from another state who's part of that, one of the big donors to that. And I'm in this room with all these people whose net worth is so significant, and I find out that they are scared to death. I'm thinking, well, you know, if you got money, you shouldn't be worried about it. And they told me, well, if you got money, you can lose it. I thought, yeah, I never thought of that. I guess I don't have any money. Never even occurred to me. One of my buddies was telling me he was on vacation in Europe. Like, who goes on vacation in Europe? He was on vacation in Europe, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, he couldn't sleep. He kept getting up to find out what was going on in the stock market because of how much money he was losing, and it was just driving him crazy. And I thought, you know, like, that's so weird, so different. But, you know, lots and lots of people are faced with difficulty, and they're worried about it. And, you know, in the midst of all that, we often have to pause and ask ourselves the question, where does our security really lie? Do we really believe that God is in control and that God can work great things in bad times? Amen. I like that. Great things in bad times. Is it possible that at what appears to be the greatest moment of your personal instability, that God could be opening a door for the greatest opportunity of your influence for the gospel of Jesus Christ? In other words, this time in your life, right now, may be the most significant time for you to come to grips with what you trust in, who you are in Jesus Christ, and what you can do for His kingdom than any other time. Maybe God designed this disaster for you. Say, well, like, where are you getting that from? Well, I'm getting that from history. In fact, we're going to look at a book in history, the history of the Old Testament. And I want you to open your Bibles to Daniel chapter 1. We're going to spend some time in Daniel over the next couple of weeks. The book of Daniel is a phenomenal book. It's a book about turmoil. And it's also a book about the sovereignty and control of God. The first six chapters tell the story of Daniel's life and what he experienced. And then the second six chapters talk about prophecy and how God's got control not only of individual lives, but also of the world stage. And so we'll be looking at this book, half of it, during this half of the year as we finish up. And then this prophecy section we'll be looking at in the start of the new year. I thought it would just be so appropriate because many of the things that we're feeling were things that Daniel experienced. And we want to look at this study together. As we open the book of Daniel, we're just going to start right in chapter 1. We're going to dive in right here. And in the first verse, it says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. These he carried off into the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God." Now, as we dive into this, let me just kind of give you the background of what's taking place, because everything from the standpoint of Daniel and his people is out of control. I mean, this is out of control. Jehoiakim comes to the throne, and 3 years after he's on the throne, Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest power in the ancient Middle East at that point in time, decides that he's going to take out Judah, that's going to be a target that he's going to go after. Now, historically, this happens in 605 BC. We know from history, from the other texts of ancient history, that Nebuchadnezzar made his way down to Egypt, conquered Egypt, and after he conquered Egypt, he made his way up and besieged the city of Jerusalem. What's phenomenal is we've got all of this in the Bible, and then we've got all of this recorded in secular history alongside of it. It's amazing when you study the parallels to see the accuracy of the scriptures. And so when an ancient Near Eastern king or monarch decides to besiege a city for conquest, he doesn't have a copy of the Geneva Convention in front of him. The idea of genocide was considered a positive thing, not a negative thing. These folks were barbaric in the way they treated people. So to besiege the city of Jerusalem literally means I would rather have you starve than have my soldiers get killed. So we're going to wrap our soldiers around the city. We're going to keep you inside until you run out of food, until you run out of water, until your women and children die, and then you're going to give up. And that's exactly what Jehoiakim did. When he saw the magnitude of the army and their food supply and how long it was going to be, he eventually gave up and he surrendered. And in the course of that surrender, Nebuchadnezzar came in and he took symbolically the articles of gold and silver that were used in temple worship. Now we're going to see those again in chapter 5, so just log that in the back of your mind. These were the articles that were used in temple worship, and then he also took possession or control, left Jehoiakim as the vassal. By the way, he's going to come back 2 more times in the next few years, and the last time he comes back, he's going to wipe out the city, he's going to burn it to the ground, he's going to slaughter the people, but this is just the first round. And we also find out in the story that he takes some of the nobility, particularly targeting the young people, and he drags them in captivity back to Babylon. Everything is out of control. Not only have they lost their economy, not only is the person in power a problem, but people are literally starving to death, they're being carried away, and Daniel and his friends are going to be shackled together, and they're going to march 800 miles around the desert to a land that is different than any place they've ever been. That's the plight or the condition of Daniel and his friends as we start this book. As you look at it, it says that in verse 3, that he carried these, verse 2, he carried these to the temple of his God in Babylonia. The word translated Babylonia there is the archaic word Shinar, which is where the Tower of Babel is built. So in that land, the land of Babylon, the land of Shinar, that is symbolic of history that this is the seat of wickedness. In other words, the place that would be considered by the Jewish people to be the worst place to ever land is in this place. Like everything is melted down from all possible perspectives. People could look up to heaven and say, God, you've lost complete control. You've lost complete control. Well, it seems to get worse. In verse 3, it says, "Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. So what's taking place here is the ancient monarchs understood that if you could actually try to take the people and intermingle them and then take their best and brightest and incorporate them into your government, what you were doing is you were getting an inside edge on how these different people groups thought. You were also using them, like why would Jehoiakim attack or try to conquer Nebuchadnezzar when his family was literally there in captivity and part of the cabinet. So the idea was, at about age 14, they would take these guys, they would take them into a training course that lasted for 3 years, and in that training course, they would try to get them to think and act and function like a Babylonian royalty, and then they would use them in their government, and that was the strategy behind this. And what we find out is that they decide to pick some Israelite young men to participate. So we see in the next verse, among these were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. Now, let's just think about this. How many 14-year-olds do we have in the service? Okay, we have one. My son was in the last hour, so I knew we had a couple in there, a couple up here, some 14-year-olds. How many of you think that the person you're sitting next to acts like a 14-year-old at times, and this could be applicable to them? Yeah, I see some of you ladies pointing at your husband. These guys are young. They've been taken away from their family, and they're brought into a whole new wild world. Now, the goal is to get these guys to think and act and be loyal to the conquering king. In other words, they're going to actually be part of the team that interacts and helps the king strategize on how to rule the government and how to rule the world. The conqueror is now going to be the one they're trying to help, the man who is killing their families and wiping out their economy. You talk about a tough place to be, and you talk about young and scared. Now, in addition to that, the text gives us a little insight into who these guys are. The qualifications to pick these guys in verse 4 is that they're young men without any physical defect. They're handsome. They're like Jonas Brothers kind of quality in their looks. They show aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed and quick to understand. These are the AP and IB students. These are the ones who are really intelligent. And in addition to that, it says that they're qualified to serve in the king's palace. That phrase, qualified to serve in the king's palace, literally refers to their poise. In other words, their mannerisms, their social skills, their ability to stand in the presence of royalty and not be intimidated, but show the proper respect, that all came from their background because these kids were all raised in the palace. And so the ability to look someone in the eye, the ability to reach out your hand and shake hands with them. You know, mom, some of you guys have 16-year-old boys that still can't do that. When they meet somebody, they still can't look them in the eye, make eye contact, smile, give a firm handshake because they're shy. And, you know, you got to protect them because they're just 16-year-old boys. Get out of the way. Learning how to be able to interact is an important quality. Now, that has nothing to do with this text, but I just, you know, just like, let's get some men here. Let's turn our young people into some men who can handle themselves in a public setting. So anyway, so much for that. And the goal was to teach them, look what it says, to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The language of Babylon was Akkadian. It was written on cuneiform tablets. By the way, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of these tablets that have been preserved. So we understand the language and the literature of these people, and they were actually being educated in the ways of Babylonian thinking, which was very superstitious. They worship multiple gods. These young men were not going to be protected from the pagan thought of their day, which I know as parents, a lot of us think that in these United States that some people are trying to influence my kids with wrong worldviews. These kids were going to actually be learning and being tested and being indoctrinated in the ways of their pagan captors. That's what they're going to be facing. In addition to that, they're going to get a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. So they're going to be treated somewhat like royalty as they go through this process. The goal is to bring them over and then incorporate them into the government. Now, you may look at this and say, what in the world could God possibly be thinking? Not only does the kingdom get wiped out, but the best and the brightest get carried away, and these kids are put in this horrible, horrible situation. God's lost control, right? Well, not if you look at the passage. Now look back at verse 2, and you'll notice what it says. It says in verse 2, "And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand." The word there, Lord, is not the normal word used for God. It's the word Adonai, which means the sovereign one, or the one that's in control. When Daniel writes this book, he wants us to know that this is God who is in control, who's making this happen. And the word delivered there is the normal word, which means to give or to hand over. In other words, what he's saying is that the sovereign king took his king and handed him over to the evil king. Now, God has a myriad of ways to win battles. We see it all throughout the Old Testament. He could have changed Nebuchadnezzar's mind. He could have caused Nebuchadnezzar to be afraid of this. He could have raised up an army. Gideon only needed 300 to defeat a much more superior army. There's myriads of ways that God could have run off Nebuchadnezzar, but he chose not to do that. He allowed this to happen. In addition to that, as we read through there, we read that he gave into his hand some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, put them in the treasure house of his God. You guys know what? 100 years before this actually happened, God had already prophesied that it was going to happen. It was already predicted that this very thing was going to happen. In other words, God is saying that this tragedy, this calamity that's come on the nation of Israel, this was actually part of the plan of God. You say, show me that. Okay, let's go back to Isaiah 39. 100 years before, Hezekiah is the king. Hezekiah is pretty cocky. He believes that by his diplomacy and by his ability to form alliances, that he can, therefore, have a powerful empire. And so you know what? He forms an alliance with the Babylonians, who were not yet a world power. They were up and coming on the scene. And he brings them in and he shows them all of his gold and all the utensils of the temple and all of his treasures. And he says, look, see, I'm powerful. You and I need to be friends, right? And the prophets of God had warned these guys over and over again, do not get in bed, do not form alliances with the pagans for personal security. Well, that's what Hezekiah did. And starting in verse 3, look what the prophet says. Then Isaiah, the prophet, went to King Hezekiah and asked, what did those men say and where did they come from? From a distant land, Hezekiah replied, they came to me from Babylon. The prophet asked, what did they see in your palace? They saw everything in my palace, Hezekiah said. There is nothing among my treasures that I did not show them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your fathers have stored up until this day will be carried off to where? To Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord, and some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. 100 years before, God had told them that because of the sin of the nation of Israel, that one of the descendants of his house, Daniel and his people, they came from royalty, they came from the king's house, they would be living as eunuchs in Babylon. God's not lost control. He's working out a plan. He's got a plan. In addition to the hardships that Daniel and his friends faced, they're given new names. And those names are very interesting. We're not going to spend a lot of time on them, but just suffice it to say this, that all of the three names, or all of the four names of Daniel and his three friends, they all have something to say about their relationship to God. In other words, in Daniel's name literally means, God is my judge. All the names that were given to them were Babylonian names, and they all had references to Babylonian gods. In other words, they were saying, we're going to change your identity from being a follower of Yahweh, of God. We're going to make you worshipers of our God. So when they changed Daniel's name to Belteshazzar, literally that means Bel, or the nickname of Marduk, the head of their deity, Bel, protect his life. From God is judge to Bel, protect his life. Here's the story. The story is this, in Daniel's day and in our day as well, that God is in control when our world is in chaos. God is in control when our world is in chaos. When you think that your world is falling apart, you need to look again. Because God is in control. He's working out his sovereign plan. He's got a purpose for what's taking place, and God has a plan for your life. The question is, how are you going to personally respond to that? Which is the second principle here, and that is that God blesses those who choose his way over the easy way. God blesses those who choose his way over the easy way. Notice Daniel's dilemma in verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. With all the changes that were coming Daniel's way, one of the things that he said, no, I can't go there. Now, this kid's 14, okay? He's 14, 15 years old, about that age, and he's saying, no, I got to put my foot down on something. I can't go this way. And it came down to the Jewish dietary laws. Now, the food at the king's table that was being offered to him, even though that was the best in the land, that did not fit with the Old Testament dietary laws. Daniel, by eating that food, would become ceremonially unclean. In other words, before his God, he would not be coming into God as a clean vessel, a pure worshiper. There are several reasons why the dietary laws would be violated. First of all, the diet of the Babylonians included pork and horse meat. Both of those two things were restricted from the Jewish diet. In addition to that, Daniel was in a situation where most of the meat would be meat that was actually sacrificed or offered to idols, and Daniel might even be asked to participate in the preparation of that. And so Daniel was saying, you know what? You can take my name, you can teach me your stuff, but you can't make me ingest or to take in my body that which God has told me, don't do it. So he makes a stand here. Now, I don't know about you, but I can come up with a lot of reasons why I would compromise at this moment. In fact, let me just ask you, just take a moment, get your number one reason. What would be your number one excuse at this moment to go along with this? You got it in your head? What would you do? How would you compromise? What would you be tempted to do? Well, let me give you six of them. Reasons for not doing them. First one is to save your life. To save your life. Think about how insulting it would be to the king if you told the king, hey, your food, it's not good enough. Your gods, they're not good enough for me. You know what? I don't want your food. Take it. Keep it. Man, you could lose your life for that. In addition to that, you could say, well, you know what? All the other people are going to be doing it. Like all the other people from all the other nations that are brought in here, they're going to all be eating it. I'll be the only one that doesn't. I'll be the standout. And the peer pressure of, you know, I just need to go along and get along. So that's a great excuse that you could use. The third excuse I came up with is just the missed opportunities. Like, suppose I refuse to eat the food and I get kicked out of the program. Well, the program is going to get me into a good college. You know, that's going to get me into a good graduate school. That's going to get me into a good job. Think of all the good I could do with the influence I will have if I compromise there. It'll set me up. I'll miss out on advancement if I don't compromise here. Another one is, turn down the king's food. Man, look at it. Except for the horse meat, everything else is just like, you mean the legal drinking age for wine is 14 in Babylon? Man, I just want to indulge myself. Look at the fun, the pleasure I would be missing out on if I stuck to my principles and didn't compromise. I would say that for most young people, that's the number one issue. If I do what God's calling me to do, my friends look like they're having so much fun doing things that I know are not right. I'm going to be missing out. I'll miss out on fun. You know what? I'll grow up my whole life and I'll never have fun my whole life. My whole life will just be boring. I'll just miss out on everything. I mean, a lot of us make that excuse. The fifth one is, well, you know, I'm away from home. My priest is not here. My teachers are not here. My mentors are not here. My parents are not here. How would anybody ever know? Like, it's not that big of a deal. Nobody's going to know. Nobody's going to ever find out. So why not, in this circumstance, just compromise? The final one is probably the strongest one, and that is that since God hasn't shown up, why should I trust him? Since God hasn't shown up, why should I trust him? I mean, look at God landed me in this place. If God was powerful enough and if he loved me enough, I would have never been here in the first place. And so why should I trust him? Why should I obey him? I mean, I have that conversation from time to time with couples that are contemplating divorce. And here's how it goes. It goes like this. Well, you know, God hasn't shown up in our marriage. We don't get along. We're hating this marriage. So because God hasn't shown up and things are not going well, why should we keep our promise to him and to each other and just do that because it's the right thing to do when God hasn't come through for me? He hasn't done for me what I wanted him to do. You ever find yourself in a situation where compromise seems to be the easiest way? And this comes back to me vividly because I was a freshman in high school, like 14 years old, and I got invited to my first party. I'm popular now. People like me. So I'm going to my first party. Now, I grew up in a really, 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 really legalistic, conservative Baptist church. And so, I mean, they had some rules there. What's funny is today, if you're really, really conservative with your kids, you don't let them date. You make them court. You don't let them date, but you do let them dance. Back then, we could dance, but we could date, but we couldn't dance because dancing, like you get your body parts moving and all kinds of sin happens. And so, you know, that was kind of the rule. You know, you can't really dance. And from the time I was young, I was taught don't dance, you know, you can't really dance. And I really couldn't dance. You know, Albert Brenneman in the movie Hitch, you know, that was me making the pizza, rolling the dough, you know, that's about as good as I could do, but I, you know, so I go to the party and, you know, I'm going through my checklist. You know, you guys got your checklist, don't you? Your mom and dad gave you a checklist. Like, here's the things to watch out for. So, you know, if they're smoking dope, like, you can't go in that room or don't go out on the back porch if they're smoking dope. You know, if they're drinking, oh, yeah, you know, you probably call, have me come get, you know, can't be around that. So I got that all worked out. If they're dancing, well, of course they're going to dance. But you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to say, I don't really dance. And everybody would accept that because they knew me, because I went to that church, and nobody at that church danced. They didn't have any other things that they did fun either, but that we didn't dance. So I'm standing there at this party, and, you know, the music's playing, and back then they had the red, green, and blue lights are flashing, you know, it was really cool, and, you know, the black light and all that kind of stuff, and I'm standing there, and the music's playing, and I'm kind of, and here comes Sue Bell. And Sue Bell walks up to me and says, do you want to dance? And I went, well, Sue, you know, I'm a Christian. and I don't dance, so no. And then, about 10 minutes later, Bonnie House came up, and she said, "Tim, do you want to dance?" And I said, "Absolutely." That's Bonnie House. And so we danced. I mean, it's pretty hard to, you know, it's pretty hard to kind of do anything sinful except, you know, with that kind of dancing, because you didn't ever get close to the person with all that motion. But we danced, and while we were out there dancing, I remember just as clear today as it was when I was 14 years old, and that was a long time ago. I remember coming up from my eyes being closed while I'm doing these movements or whatever it is, and looking across the room, and there was Sue Bell standing in the background looking right at me. And I realized everything that I've ever said about myself, my character, and my faith just went right out the window. I have just compromised, and it would have been better for me to never have made a stand in the first place than to back off. And it, I mean, that's one of those things that you go back and you apologize to the person afterwards, but you're never going to get out of that one, especially Sue Bell. House girls, never get out of that one. And I knew in my heart that I had not just been displeasing to my God and offensive to Sue, but I had damaged me, who I was as a person, had now been diminished. And that's what Daniel says in this passage. Look at what he says in verse 8. He says, "But Daniel resolved himself. He resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine." Daniel's not saying, well, there's a list in the temple that's written down, and the Gentile food and the Gentile wine, stay away from that because that's bad. What Daniel is saying is that this is about who I am as a person and my ability to make a decision about the principles that I believe in. Or to compromise is a blight on my person. And if I want to be a true worshiper of God, then the person I need to bring to God is a person who's a person of integrity, a person who tells the truth, a person who sticks by their principles. And if I compromise, it diminishes who I am. Now, young people, let me tell you something that is just kind of an overarching lie. You think that what you do when you're young has no impact on who you're going to be when you get older. Because you think at 18, 19, 20, 21, 25, there's going to be this switch that's going to flip. And all of a sudden, you're going to regain all the purity of your character that you just kind of threw away at youth. And you know what? That is not true. That is a lie from the pit of hell. Your dad is not a liar. Because at 40 years of age, he started lying. Your dad is a liar because he started lying when he was 14. And he continued to lie when he was 15. And it got easier when he was 16. And easier when he was 17. And easier when he was 18. And that's who he became. He became a liar. Because every one of those decisions was a damaging of his person. And now he doesn't even see it. He lies and he gives excuses as to why it's right. Because that's who he is now. He's just deeply flawed. And oftentimes we think that the decisions that we make today don't really matter that much because we can always change them tomorrow. And what we don't realize is that the decisions we make today shape the person we will be tomorrow. And so what you're doing now with your thought life will create the addictions and the dependencies that you will live with as an adult. what you're doing now with laziness will create within you an inability to get motivated later on. What you're doing now with the mistreatment of people like mom and dad, disrespecting those people, will create in you an attitude that will disrespect your spouse and your children later on. What you're doing today will make a difference in who you're becoming tomorrow. And some of us are 45 years old and we don't get that yet. We don't understand that yet. We think tomorrow the alarm's going to ring and we're going to get up out of bed and we're going to say, okay, just like Samson did. Okay, new day, new situation. I will arise and I will shake myself off and I'll go out and I'll have the same strength that I had before to make this resolve. And you find out that the strength has left you because you've become a person that is reflective of the decisions and the choices and the compromises you made along the way. Daniel said, not me. At 14, I'm going to set a pattern of life. And that pattern of life is to fear God more than the ease of my situation. And because of that, God does some incredible things in the passage. Notice what happens. Verse 8, but Daniel resolved himself not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. So he's going to appeal to authority in a kind, loving way. We know God is working. Verse 9 says, and God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. Notice that he showed that sympathy to Daniel, but Daniel didn't even know that before he went, and he asked him. So Daniel's going in there, terrified, and he's asking him. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord, the king. That word Adonai again. He's got a king over him. He's got a lord over him. He's more afraid of his lord than he is of Daniel's lord. That's going to turn upside down in the next chapter. Who has assigned your food and drink, why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. So Daniel gives up. No, that's not what verse 11 said. Then Daniel said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel. So now he goes to the second line, goes to the second level manager, and he says, hey, let me propose an idea, an opportunity here. The official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. And some of you are thinking, I knew that being a vegan was the right thing to do. Like, that's just the right thing. Well, that's not exactly what this passage is referring to. Vegetables means everything that grows up from seed, so it would include bread and pasta and all that kind of stuff. But Daniel wants to make sure, because the meat was almost all offered to idols, he's excluding that from his diet. So he's cutting down on the just straight-up protein that would come his way. That's what he proposes. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished. The word better nourished means fatter. They looked fatter than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. He asked for a test. The guy was willing to try it. God blessed him in that test. And they were able, without causing a huge problem, they were able to appeal to the king and get something changed. Notice what happens, verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. God blessed them with their abilities. Some of you guys are flirting on the edge and also failing in school. And you're wondering to yourself, like, why can't I make the grade? Some of you adults are flirting on the edge and struggling in your jobs. And you're asking yourself the question, why can't I have the focus? Why can't I have the insight? Why can't I do this effectively? Because your morality affects your mind as well. And it impacts the way you think and the way you perform. God's blessing these guys by giving them incredible supernatural insight. And he gives Daniel something even over and above that. And Daniel could understand all kinds of visions and dreams. We're going to see that in the next chapter as well. At the end of the time set by the king, remember that was 3 years, to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better. They're 17 now. 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. The thing that's significant about that is King Cyrus is a Persian king of the Medes and the Persians. Okay? Daniel is going to outlive his Babylonian kings. He will outsurvive the empire that hauled him into captivity. Principles of application. Number one, we must accept that the circumstances of our lives are within God's control. The circumstances of our lives are within God's control. God is working in your world. You've got to accept that and embrace that and believe that. Secondly, we need to settle the battle between principles, that's principles, not principals. We need to settle the battle between principles and preferences. Principles are things that we do not compromise on. They're the truth, the guiding star by which we live. Preferences are things that we will do if it works out, if it's easy, if it fits. That's the tension. And most of us have preferences that we're calling principles. In other words, if I get in this situation with this person, and she's a Bonnie House, like, I'm going to change because I don't get these opportunities. If I get this opportunity for this job promotion, even though it may negatively affect everybody else in my world, I'm going to take it because I don't get that often. Or if nobody's looking, I'm free to do this. That's the difference between principles and preferences. What are your principles? I just want to point out one more thing from the text. What was Daniel's name? What did it mean? Daniel meant what? My God, God is my judge. What was the name that they gave him? The name they gave him was Bel, or Marduk, will protect you. He'll be your protector. Isn't that ironic? And Daniel understood, you know what? There is nothing under heaven that's going to keep me safe. But I will stand before God someday, and I'll give an account for what I did. You need to win the battle of how I'll treat people. You're going to treat people as created in the image of God, treat them with respect, or do you use people? Number two, you need to win the battle of how you behave. That's your ethics. You're going to choose to be a person who keeps your word, who lives out your values and your principles, or are you somebody who you live loose? And number three, how will I treat God? How will I treat God? Does God get my priorities, my time? Does he get my priorities, my resources? Does he get my priorities, my thoughts? Or do I tack God on at the end? Those are the difference between the principles and preferences. Principles and preferences. Now, as we wrap up our service, I just want us to spend a moment in meditation. So I'm going to ask you guys just to bow your heads. Just bow your heads right now. Because I don't want us to leave here having learned about Daniel. I want us to leave here having learned about me. Having learned about my life before God. So here's my question I want you to meditate on. Just quiet by yourself. Just in this moment, just quiet by yourself. Meditate on this. Just ask yourself the question, do I believe that God is sovereign? That he alone is in charge of this world. That whether things are good or whether things are bad in my life, that God is the supreme one. And do I bend my will to his will? Let's pause and think about that together.